In Job chapters 6 and 7, we find the response of Job to Eliphaz, or as we discussed earlier when we introduced these speeches, it's very difficult to say that one is literally a response, because a lot of the response is more indirect than direct, and a great deal that you find in the speeches is not responsive at all. Perhaps a more accurate denomination for 6 and 7 might simply be Job's first speech, but it's generally referred to as the response to Eliphaz because it follows right after Eliphaz's first speech. So that'll be our topic this morning. I don't know that we'll get through chapters 6 and 7 in their entirety, but at any rate, for next Lord's Day, be looking at chapter 8. And that contains Bildad's first speech. And we'll be looking at that hopefully next Sunday. Bildad, by the way, this just bit of Old Testament trivia, is one of the shortest people in the Bible. Bildad the Shuhite. No extra charge for that this morning. That's bad. But Peter's actually the shortest man. He was able to sleep on his watch. All right. Bill says that's worse than more of it. All right. Got all that important stuff out of the way this morning. Let's look at Job chapter 6 and 7. As we discussed at the end of Eliphaz's speech, unless we understand what Job is about, we're probably not ready for what follows Eliphaz's speech. Job defends himself with a rather emotional outburst. Then Job answered. And it seems the word, when it just simply says, then Job answered, it seems almost as if it's going to be sort of a calm response. But if you've read chapter 6 and 7, you know that Job's response is anything but calm. It is an emotional outburst in which he defends himself, not, as we will see in what Job says, against a direct charge. In fact, he calls for them, if you're going to say something to me, say it plainly. Have you ever known folks who would go 97 miles out of the way to say something obliquely when they could say it in a straightforward fashion, but they just don't choose to do that? I guess they're afraid somebody would understand them. So Eliphaz spent a great deal of time insinuating, implying that Job was a sinner. If you weren't a sinner, Job, these things would not have happened to you. And Job was a rather intelligent person, and he did not miss the insinuation, the implication. He was able to infer exactly what Eliphaz wanted him to infer. And so Job answered. And in verses 2 to 7, Job takes the position that his words that he spoke in his lamentation, and I think applicable to everything that Job is going to say in the book of Job, his words are fully justified. Oh, that my vexation were actually weighed and laid in the balances together with my iniquity. For then it would be heavier than the sand of the seas. Therefore, my words have been rash. Now, you know, every once in a while, when somebody makes a rash statement, and somebody sort of gets in their face and calls their hand on it, which is basically what Eliphaz had done, people start saying, well, you didn't understand me. Well, I didn't really mean that. Well, I'm sorry I spoke rashly. Job doesn't say any of that. Job admits that he spoke rashly. Therefore, my words have been rash. He's not been sobered by Eliphaz's reproof. He's not been softened by what Eliphaz had said. Job not only admits that his words were rash, but he says they were fully justified. Oh, that my vexation were actually weighed. If it could be put in the balance scales, then you'd find that everything I said weighs out okay. Now, truth of the matter is, that's not the best way in the world to approach things. Because when we start putting things in balance scales, we generally start weighing things according to our understanding and our human weights, don't we? And it is impossible for a balanced scale mentality to perhaps understand is not the right word. Maybe I ought to say it is not possible for a balanced scale mentality to accept or understand the ways of God. But we generally start wanting to weigh things with God. Sort of a this for that, a quid pro quo, a tit for tat situation. And we put something in the balance scale and we want God to put something in the balance scale. And somehow we believe that we're going to put enough in to balance what God is doing. But that cannot be done. And we understand that it cannot be done, at least theoretically we understand, that it cannot be done in relationship to what God has done for us in Jesus Christ. That when God puts our salvation through Jesus Christ in the scale, it goes down and there isn't anything that we can put on the other side that's going to bring it up and balance it. Man can't do enough. He can't accomplish enough. He can't even dream enough to balance what God has done for us through Jesus Christ. Even after we've done everything that is commanded us, we ought to say we are still unprofitable servants. We have done that which it was our duty to do. So we want to put things in the balance scale. And when we put things in the balance scale on the evil side, that's how we sort of start accounting for suffering and for evil in the world. And yet we are really poor at accounting and rationalizing suffering. We're even poor at doing anything about it. And it's just almost absolutely impossible for us to be anything other than devastated when it is our turn to suffer. Now, we can fully understand what's wrong with the other folks, sort of like Job's friends. Well, he got what he deserved, didn't he? Isn't that balance scale mentality? You got what you, it got weighed out to you? Exactly what you had coming. We can rationalize the sufferings of others, but when it comes our turn to suffer, there isn't any explanation, there isn't any rationalization, there is just unexplained suffering by which we are devastated. Job was in that condition. Well, Job needs to talk to somebody, and he has some friends here that we're going to discover didn't say the right things. And he winds up, he starts here in this speech for the first time talking directly to God. And we'll see that as it begins. He begins to pray. But I hesitate to say that Job was real happy in these circumstances. I think Job was not satisfied. The one thing that Job did not do, and this I think says the same thing you're saying, Job never lost his faith in God. And it was out of his faith that he was crying out, seeking some answers. God, if you're the God and the kind of God in whom I believe, then why am I in this situation? And he's asking some answers and asking some questions. But he feels very definitely that God is arrayed against him. And he's fixing to tell us why he thinks his words, his rash words, are justified. For the arrows of the Almighty are within me, their poison my spirit drinks, the terrors of God are arrayed against me. Job is terrified. He describes God in verse 4 as being in battle array. And who's the enemy? It's Job. God is in battle array. That's what that word means. Not just arrayed, it's battle array that God has brought to bear against Job. And for the first time, here in verse 4, Job identifies God as the cause of his suffering. Now that's where Job is coming from. Job doesn't know. He doesn't have the advantage that we have to see what's going on behind the scenes. All he knows is that he's sitting there in an ash heap, and he believes that God controls everything, and therefore, God is arrayed against him. In verses 5 to 7, he asks some rhetorical questions. And basically, what he's getting at here, does the wild donkey bray over his grass, or does the ox low over his fodder? Can something tasteless be eaten without salt, or is there any taste in the white of an egg? My soul refuses to touch them. They are like loathsome food to me. And what he's getting at with these questions is that the speech of Eliphaz is absolutely insipid. It is so insipid that it is like tasteless food that can be nauseating if it's not spiced up a bit. And that's what Job is saying here. He's saying that this dish that Eliphaz has served up to him is tasteless, and it's making him sick. It just nauseates me, and it doesn't do anything for my soul. And Job doesn't just sit there and take it. When Eliphaz makes the speech, Job doesn't sit there, must be. Job says, Eliphaz, what you're saying nauseates me, and he tells him directly about it and how it makes him feel. Let me ask you a question. How would you feel if you got invited someplace for a real fancy dinner, and you were called in to go to the dining room table, and there was the best silver? Maybe not even silver, maybe some of this gold-plated stuff. It was there on the table, and, I mean, the tablecloth was spread. It's not, you know, fancy. When you got cloth tablecloths and cloth napkins, you know you're uptown. And so all of this was done. It was all there. The crystal was on the table, the kind that you go, and it goes, bing. I mean, it is fancy. Everybody is seated at the table, and the hostess comes in and raises her fork. Anything wrong with this picture? No food on the table. No food on the table. And Job is basically saying to Eliphaz, Eliphaz, you are that kind of person. You brought me in here and you set a table before me, and there isn't anything on it, Eliphaz, that is worth eating. And not only that, but what little you put out there makes me nauseatingly sick. Do you think Job knows how to speak plainly? I think he probably has Eliphaz's attention by now. One thing is certain, what Eliphaz had to say to Job didn't change Job's mind about anything that he said in his lamentation. Job said in the lamentation, I want to die. And in verses 8 to 10, he still says that he wishes to die. Oh, that my request might come to pass and that God would grant my longing. Would that God were willing to crush me, that he would loose his hand and cut me off. But it is still my consolation, and I rejoice in unsparing pain that I have not denied the words of the Holy One. In these verses, Job prays. At least I read it as a prayer. Oh, that my request, my prayer might come to pass, and that God would grant my longing. You remember what Eliphaz said to Job back in chapter 5 and verse 8? He basically said, you know, if I were in your place, The New American Standard here says, "But as for me." Now, the way you and I would say that, Job, if I were you, I would seek God and I would place my cause before God. Job is taking Eliphaz's advice. And he's coming in and he's saying, let me tell you, I place myself before God. I want God to grant my request. I want God to grant my longing. I want God to crush me. I want God to loose his hand and cut me off. And if he should do that, I have at least this consolation. I have not denied God. Job still maintains his faith. Job is not yet questioning. He doesn't question the fact that God gives and God can take away. Blessed be the name of Jehovah. It would be his consolation, and he would rejoice in unsparing pain in his death if God should cut him off immediately in response to his prayer that he still had not denied the Holy One. Verses 11 to 23. Job expresses that his hope that his friends would refresh him has been disappointed, and it has left him even more desperate than he would have been without them. What is my strength that I should wait? And what is my end that I should endure? You remember what Eliphaz said to him in chapter 5, about verses 17 to 27? Job, just be patient. It'll all work out after a while. You get yourself right and things will turn around and it'll be all right, Job. Job says, I don't have strength to do that. You know, what Eliphaz and the friends are doing is sort of like going up to a person with acute appendicitis and say, now, you know, you ought to stop feeling such intense pain. And that's sort of the kind of advice that we give sometimes. And Job is saying, that doesn't do much for the soul because you see where I am, sitting out here on my ash heap. And he's going to describe himself in a terrible way here in just a little bit. Job just doesn't have the strength to hold out for the promised renewal that Eliphaz has said he's going to receive. Verses 12 and 13, Job doesn't have any false fortitude of any kind. All of his resources are spent. All of his endurance is left. Is my strength the strength of stones, or is my flesh bronze? Is it that my help is not within me and that deliverance is driven from me? I just don't have it anymore. For the despairing man, there should be kindness from his friend, lest he forsake the fear of the Almighty. Beginning in verse 14, Job makes a more direct attack upon his friends. By their failure, they have forfeited their claim to be righteous men in the minds of Job. As a matter of fact, the disappointment that Job feels is even greater because Eliphaz came in and in his confidence he promised so very much. Well, let me tell you what's wrong with you. No doubt in his voice. No hesitation in his approach. Here is the person with the solution. And not only does it not solve Job's problem, it exacerbates it. And so Job is doubly disappointed because, you know, it's sort of like a person crawling across a desert, dying of thirst. And lo and behold, here comes somebody running with a canteen. And you think, oh, I'm going to get that drink of water. And he turns it up and it's empty. You see, the anticipation of help increases the darkness of the disappointment. Now, you remember, at the end of Eliphaz's speech, we asked the question, what was wrong with Eliphaz? And we suggested that one of the things that was wrong with Eliphaz was the fact that he was a poor counselor. Even when Eliphaz spoke the truth, he spoke it in a manner that didn't apply to and didn't help Job. And the same thing is going on here. You see, Eliphaz, in some respects, was doctrinally sound, but had no compassion for people. And it takes both. Doctrinal soundness without compassion is wrong. And compassion without doctrinal soundness is wrong. It takes both. And here came Eliphaz. He spoke some right things. But he had no compassion or understanding for Job's situation. That's right. Eliphaz did have a conceited assumption that he knew everything. And he was wrong on both counts. Now look what Job says about his reaction to how he was treated. He suggests that his friends have proved false like a desert wadi stream. My brothers have acted deceitfully like a wadi, like the torrents of wadis which vanish. He describes them in the winter and in the summer, which are turbid because of ice and into which the snow melts. When they become waterless, they are silent. When it is hot, they vanish from their place. Sort of like we described the man in the desert wanting water. He goes seeking, he's disappointed. Verse 18, there are travelers who count on the wadis for water, but it's gone and they perish. The paths of their course wind along, they go into nothing and perish. Verse 19, the merchants are disappointed as Job was with his friends. The caravans of Temah looked, the travelers of Sheba hoped for them. Verse 20, he says that they were all the more disappointed because their hopes had been built up. They were disappointed for they had trusted. They came there and were confounded. Isn't that the worst kind of disappointment? To be disappointed by someone whom you have trusted. And Job says, that's the way it is with you, my friends. I look to you for help, and I receive none. Verse 21, Job expresses a little bit of understanding. Indeed, you have now become such, you see a terror and are afraid. Why do Job's friends take the position that they take? Because they've come out to the ash heap. And they have seen Job's condition. And they understand, they assume that Job's condition is the result of God's wrath. And they assume that if they sit around and associate with Job, God's wrath may spill over on them. So they're afraid. They see a terror and they are afraid. They don't want to be an object of God's wrath. In verses 22 and 23, Job disclaims that he's made any excessive demands on these people, either by way of money, verse 22, or by way of putting them in harm's way, in danger, asking them to take any risk. Have I said, give me something? Or offer a bribe for me from your wealth? Or deliver me from the hand of the adversary? Or redeem me from the hand of tyrants? Job said, I haven't asked you for any of that. What had Job asked him for? He had asked him for something. All Job had asked of them was the loyalty of a friend. That's where he started in verse 14. For the despairing man, there should be kindness from his friend, lest he forsake the fear of the Almighty. That is all he had asked. That's all he wanted from them. In the end of the chapter, verses 24 to 30, Job makes a blunt summary of what he has said. He speaks very plainly and asks them to do the same. What Job says is, one commentator said, as plain as a court indictment. It'll come through clearly. Basically, what he's doing, he's challenging his friends to be straightforward in their accusations that they have made against him. Teach me, and I will be silent. And show me how I have erred. How painful are honest words. But what does your argument prove? Now remember that the inference that Job had sinned was latent in the speech that Eliphaz had made. And Job is saying, all right, I hear you. I understand what you're saying. But the problem with what you have said is that it is vague, it is general, and it doesn't tell me what I have done wrong. And Job says, now you speak plainly. If you are accusing me of wrong, don't do it by inference, by implication. Don't do it by insinuation. But you just come right out and you tell me, teach me, and I will be silent. All it will take to silence Job. He said, yes, I spoke rashly, but my words are justified. Now, if you don't think they are, and you just tell me very plainly what it is, and that is going to silence me, I will be quiet. How painful. Some translations render it, how forceful are honest words. Words of truth are always weighty words. They are always impressive words. And Job says, if you speak words of truth to me, teach me, then I am going to be quiet. But what does your argument prove? Basically, Job is saying, what you've said thus far proves absolutely nothing. Do you intend to reprove my words? When the words of one in despair belong to the wind? They have treated his words as something to be blown away, just ignored. You would even cast lots for the orphans and barter over your friend. Do you realize that Job can give as good as he gets? When it comes to gratuitous accusations, Job's friends haven't gone anywhere, or else Job is a quick learner. Where in anything that the friends have said is there any insinuation that they would go in and gamble over orphans? Where is anything in what has been said that they would barter over their friend? I can't find it. And maybe that's Job's point. Maybe Job is saying, if you just want to make baseless, senseless, unsupported accusations, then let me throw a couple at you. Sometimes that does make people think, doesn't it? But be that as it may, Job seems to join in the fray. But now Job is getting serious. And now please look at me. Parents, when you're talking to your kids? Do those words ring a bell? Look at me when I'm talking to you. Yeah, they ring a bell. Some of us have said it, some of us have heard it, and some of us have both heard it and said it. I fall into the latter category. Look at me. There is fixing to be some significant communication. And Job says, you turn to me, you look at me, and for the moment, Job puts away his death wish as the central theme of what he is saying, and the challenge, the questioning, the challenge to and the questioning of his integrity becomes his central theme. Some suggest that a new part of the speech begins in verse 28 because New American Standard begins and now, other translations begin, but now. Please look at me and see if I lie to your face. Desist now, let there be no injustice, even desist, my righteousness is yet in it. Is there injustice on my tongue? Cannot my palate discern calamities? Basically, Job is saying here, look, we put it in modern parlance. You want me to submit to a lie detector, you just go get the man in the machine to run it. And you examine me. And we'll see if I'm telling the truth or not when I say that I've not sinned. Turning to Job may involve a change of attitude. That may be what he's suggesting here. And the attitude that he would want changed is, do not gratuitously assume my guilt. Don't assume that I am a sinner. Because I'm a discerning person. I can discern, I can taste, as it were, in my palate, the kind of calamity and the reason for my calamity. I know my life. I know what's going on. And there is no injustice in my tongue, and I'm not lying to you. So don't challenge my integrity. Chapter 7 is more like a soliloquy in which Job talks to God. And as he talks to God, what Job is saying turns into a remonstration against God. He gets rather remonstrative with him. Verses 1 to 10, he returns to his theme of death. The only way out is death. And the sooner the better is Job's message. Is not man forced to labor on earth? And are not his days like the days of a hired man? As a slave who pants for the shade, and as a hired man who eagerly waits his wages? I won't ask for a show of hands, but how many of you love your work? How many of you hate your work? There is no greater burden than to have to do something that you hate doing. Now, I personally vowed a long time ago that I would never work for a living. And I never have. But I define working for a living as doing something that I don't want to do with people I don't want to do it with. It is real work to go to the ballet. Even with people I want to do it with. Well, even with people I enjoy being with. That's something I don't want to do with anybody. Sorry, Millie. But that's just one of the facts of life. It's terrible work. And yeah, Job is suggesting here that it gets real burdensome when what one is doing is not of one's own choosing. And further, when there is no reward for having done it. And that's what he's saying my situation is. Man's situation is. He's forced to labor on the earth. His days are the days of a hired man. as a slave who pants for the shade. I don't want to do it, and it's not being done for my benefit. He's talking about, as his theme, the hard service that men have upon the earth. So I am allotted months of vanity, and nights of trouble are appointed me. But where am I going to find relief? Oh, when I get through with the day and I lay down at night. Now I lay me down to sleep and pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, that assumes you're going to sleep, doesn't it? When I lie down, I say, when shall I arise? And the night continues, and I am continually tossing until dawn. He hopes to find relief in his sleep, but the nighttime is a time of tossing and turning. Haven't you been there? When shocks come because of deprivation of some kind, the loss of, it might be money, it might be a loved one, no telling what it is. But we hope to find some relief in sleep, but it doesn't come. We toss and turn. Indeed, the nighttime makes it worse, doesn't it? Everything seems to get worse in the darkness. My flesh is clothed with worms and a crust of dirt. My skin hardens and runs. Mental anguish that Job is suffering is inseparable from physical pain. And this description that Job gives here of his physical condition is about as pitiable as anything that you will ever have. This translation says, I'm clothed with worms. The worms are literally maggots. I am wearing maggots like a suit. They are all over me, like a shirt. He is caked with dirt, a crust of dirt. My skin hardens and runs. He is scabby and festering. Is that the kind of friend you want to go be with? Bob? But you'll probably bring it up at lunch, won't you? My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle and come to an end without hope. What a pitiable lament. As Job describes his situation, my days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle. Life is short, it's hard, it's suffering. Some suggest that come to an end without hope should be translated come to an end as the thread runs out. Either one is descriptive of the life of man and the uncertainty of that life. Job is in a bad condition. And can't we sympathize with his friends? Don't we feel that way sometimes? And that's where we'll start with verse 7 next Lord's Day morning. Don't we really have in our mind the idea that if the physical body is rotting away, what must the soul be? You and I leave here, and we go and we see somebody who is in the picture of health, all dressed up, Sunday go to meeting best. And we think, boy, they must be all right. But on the way to wherever we go to eat, we, as we drive down the street, look to the right or the left, and there on the corner, we see the bum with the sign. Or we see the bag man or the bag lady pulling or pushing their cart behind them with all of their worldly possessions in it. And we see them dirty and filthy and ragged, and we think, they're not worn. What must their soul be like? Think about Job's friends before we condemn them too severely for their attitude toward Job, and wonder, might we not be thinking the same thing as we see Job sitting in a condition worse than any bum, vagrant, whatever word you want to use, than you and I have ever seen. Maybe it's time for us to examine our own attitudes and look again at those to whom we as Christians owe a duty in Jesus Christ, though especially to the household of faith, we are to do good unto all men. Next week we'll begin chapter 7, verse 7. Read through the end of that chapter again and read also chapter 8.